Hello and welcome to Moss. It lurks beneath the surface, tying together organized networks across all levels of society. It exploits the weak and vulnerable, disguising slave-like jobs and sex work with promises of better prospects. We're talking about human trafficking, an illicit multi-billion dollar industry operating all over the world. In this podcast, we're finding out how it affects the Rohingya, both in leaving Myanmar and in the camps. The trafficking networks in Southeast Asia have existed for as long as there have been a demand for them. For the Rohingya, this started as a way for men to smuggle themselves to places like Bangladesh, Thailand, or Malaysia to find work. Decades of persecution and state violence have forced whole families, young and old, to flee Rakhine State, taking great risks in the process. According to Sunay Fazook, Senior Asia Researcher for Human Rights Watch, traffickers prey on desperation, employing brutal tactics to exploit and extort without accountability, and they're organized across every level. The Rohingya are among their victims.
Often that the trafficking of Rohingya in Rakhine State of Burma, Myanmar, started with the persecution, the hardship, and human rights abuses that happened on the ground. People then, you know, seek to find way to escape from dangers, and that start to push them toward criminal networks that operate as part of the trafficking ring in their livelihood. So basically it started with traffickers who operate inside Rakhine State of Burma, Myanmar, who start to give promises to the Rohingyas that they can be provided with escape route, with ships that will bring them to safer destination. The fee will be often, you know, set out very clearly to them. Often it's about $2,000 to $3,000, and it can be paid on spot partly, and then with clear promises by Rohingya who want to escape that when they arrive at the final destination, be it Malaysia or Indonesia, the rest of the payment will be made. But given the fact that Rohingya are very poor, they live in hardship and under exploitation of Burmese authority for many, many years, it seems impossible for them to actually make such payment. So they end up in a kind of bondage agreement with the traffickers that lead them into a slave-like condition when they agree to enter the trafficking provided by traffickers in Rakhine State of Burma, Myanmar, and then they would be transported onto the ship and then sent by sea. And if the ships can take them straight to Malaysia, so that's one scenario. Another scenario that happened in the past was that the journey from Rakhine State to Malaysia is considered too long, and these people are treated as merchandise. So traffickers would not want to risk wasting them in rough sea. So halfway between Rakhine State of Burma, Myanmar, and Malaysia, Thailand is a transit point. So from the big ship, they will be then, you know, divided into smaller boats and then carried to Thailand. When they arrive on the shore of Thailand, they are divided further into smaller groups and then transported by land across the border from Thailand to Malaysia. And at each point of this transit, the Rohingya are demanded to make further and further payment. Otherwise, they could have been killed, they could have been dumped overboard. The traffickers sometimes threaten to go after the rest of the families of those Rohingya who remain behind, who stay behind them. So they're basically entering into a slave-like condition. And when they reach the final transit point, that is the border between Thailand and Malaysia, they are often locked up in camps. And these camps are considered as kind of modern slavery, surrounded by armed guards. Rohingya are not allowed to leave the camps. They have not received sufficient food, no medical treatment whatsoever. Sexual violence, very common. Women and girls have been taken out, often to be raped by traffickers and security guards of the camp. The male Rohingyas there were often harassed and roughed up in order to extort their money. And for those who fail to make final payment, they wouldn't be allowed to cross the border into Malaysia. And that explains why we found many grapes. Some of them can be considered as mass grapes on the border between Thailand and Malaysia, where the camps that Rohingya lock up are located.
Can you explain what led up to the crackdown by the Thai authorities on the trafficking rings in 2015?
Even though the existence of camps, either the camps between Thai and Malaysian border or the camps that were located on islands in Andaman Sea, the part that belonged to Thailand, these camps were known to human rights organizations, were known to the media, and have been reported way before the crackdown in 2015. But there were no reactions from authorities, from law enforcement in Thailand, partly perhaps due to involvement of influential officials, influential politicians, and criminal gangs in Thailand. So they continue to abuse, enslave the Rohingya for decades without being touched. There were no serious investigations, no attempts to crack down on these trafficking camps at all. So for many years, the traffickers continue to operate with total impunity. The camps on the Thai-Malaysian border were left untouched. The camps on islands were left untouched. It was almost accidental that mad grapes along the Thai-Malaysian border captured international attention when there was an unrelated attempt at all to go after ethnic Uyghur from China who tried to escape through Thailand to Malaysia. The media on that day were tagging along Thai authorities to locate Rohingyas, asylum seekers and migrants, but they ended up stumbled into Rohingya trafficking camps. They found large number of evidence showing that people were locked up in those camps for many years. There were graveyards near the camps. There were bodies inside those graves. Bodies that show marks of people that starved to death or beaten to death.
Are the traffickers still operating? And if so, what have we learned about their operations?
Due to international pressures and international attention, Thai authorities eventually were forced to take serious action. Thailand was listed on Tier 3 of the US State Department report on trafficking in person. That was the lowest rank. It was threatened with sanction. So something needs to be done by Thai authorities, leading to crackdown on trafficking networks inside Thailand, leading to the exposes of senior officials involved in trafficking. They were prosecuted. They were punished severely. But this is only part of very huge operation that cut across many countries. The network of traffickers in Thailand have been disrupted and might not be able to return to their previous operation anytime soon. But the network of traffickers that exists in Rakhine State of Burma, Myanmar, that exists in Malaysia, that exists in Indonesia, are still operational and active. So it would have been better to see close coordination among governments in Southeast Asia, government of Burma, Myanmar, government of Thailand, government of Malaysia, government of Indonesia, that they all work together to bring traffickers to justice and ensure that for the Rohingyas who seek protection, who seek safer life and livelihood, they could travel with safety. They could have access to international protection mechanism provided by UN agencies.
Bangladesh is still a hotbed for Rohingya trafficking. Last year, the country was ranked on the US State Department's Tier 2 watch list due to the government's slow response to the scale of trafficking, both of Bangladeshis and the Rohingya population. Since the recent influx of Rohingya to the camps of Cox's Bazar, there have been more cases of refugees being trafficked into slave-like work or the sex industry. It's the promise of money or a better future for children that sounds very appealing to the vulnerable in the camps. Robert Bilheimer is the president and director of Worldwide Documentaries, a film company focused on human rights storytelling. He's now working on a 5-part docu-series charting human trafficking globally. Cox's Bazaar is one of his focus areas.
The project we're working on now, Heart of the Matter, is really a companion piece to Not My Life, which was a film about human trafficking globally and all the sort of the crimes connected to it and how it works and who it affects and so forth. It occurred to me about 2 years ago when I started to become aware in my travels and when I was thinking about what to do next as a human rights storyteller, that we were beginning to see this explosion of migrants and refugees on the move in all parts of the world, folks who have been forcibly displaced from their homes for any number of reasons, whether it's extreme poverty, gang violence, ethnic violence, as we see with the Rohingya in Cox's Bazaar. And I began to realize almost as an epiphany that here are 65, 75 million people on the move, and these are among the most vulnerable populations in the world. And for someone like myself who knows how human traffickers prey on precisely the vulnerability of these mobile populations and other folks who are vulnerable, poor women, children, that it didn't take a genius to see that this was like a toxic combination of trafficking industry on the one hand and the vulnerability of these people on the other. And so I began to think what I wound up calling the migration trafficking intersect. And that's how we began to develop over the last 2 years another global storytelling project about what this really means and how dangerous it really is. I think in the 25 years I've been doing this kind of work, I haven't seen anything that alarms me as much as what is happening to mobile populations on the move, forcibly displaced populations at the hands of human traffickers. It's a real tragedy, and it's getting worse.
What links have you found between mass migration and industrialized human trafficking and slavery?
The links are self-evident, it seems to me, because if you know how human traffickers operate, they fish in pools of vulnerability. And so you have to say, well, what do we mean by vulnerable? Well, a vulnerable person is a woman on the move with a daughter because she has been forced to leave her home overnight because a gang member in Honduras killed her son and is threatening to kidnap her daughter. That's a vulnerable person. And that person on a journey from Honduras to the U.S.-Mexican border is going to be approached by a human trafficker in some form. At the south end of the equation, that trafficker will more accurately be called a smuggler. That smuggler will exact a price of some kind for either that woman or her daughter. We just read recently that in the Mediterranean, kids trying to get across to this day are having to pay their transportation fees by having any number of sexual relationships that a smuggler forces them into. And that's how that smuggler will profit from the vulnerability of that child who is desperately trying to get out of these circumstances. So there is a direct correlative relationship between any of these populations, whether they're in Cox's Bazaar, whether they're coming from Central Africa, whether they're coming from South America, between their helplessness, if you will, and their vulnerability, and the traffickers are buzzing around them like flies. I mean, I could go on and on about, in the United States, what we're seeing right now, once people do, in fact, get over the border. And the same thing, by the way, is true for the Rohingya. There are people in these camps. The daughters say, oh, well, I have a job for your daughter, right? It's like a babysitting job or a domestic service. And, you know, that daughter will wind up being brutalized and trafficked. So what strikes me is that when you talk about industrialized slavery, when we were making the Not My Life film that preceded this, what What struck us more than anything was how the industry itself, the human trafficking industry, is very, very carefully thought out. That whether it's in India or whether it's in the United States, the language, the techniques, the come-ons, what they call in different languages in different parts of the world, the sweet talking. It's like any business where you have these models and these rules and these things that you go through. Look, $150, $60, $70 billion a year on the backs and beds of children, primarily. Those are big numbers. And you don't arrive at numbers like that, I don't think, without having an industry that, from top to bottom, is very carefully organized. So it should come as no surprise to anyone that we're finding human traffickers among 500,000, 600,000, 700,000 vulnerable people in Cox's Bazar who were underserved, incredibly vulnerable, no clear future. And then the even more toxic thing in this case is the Rohingya are actually feeding into the voracious human trafficking demand of India, which remains, if only because there are a billion people there, one of the largest human trafficking consuming countries in the world.
In the last few months, the media and aid agencies have been raising the profile of Rohingya trafficking. Reports of Rohingya children as young as 7 years old being rescued from pimps have shown just how rooted trafficking and the sex industry are in Bangladesh. Along with supporting victims, aid agencies like IOM are running awareness campaigns to warn families of the dangers of sweet talkers. But is it enough to break the migration trafficking intersect for the Rohingya? If you like this podcast, don't forget to hit like, comment, and subscribe for more podcasts from us. You can also follow us on our social media. Check out our latest updates on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Audioboom, or you can donate to help us help Rohingya refugees. From all of us here at Moss, goodbye.